Everybody. So welcome, everyone. My name is Dawn Rodriguez Horn, and I co-facilitate the seminar with Jen Balsagar. Welcome to the Genetic Engineers Weekly Seminar called the Colloquium. And we're very excited about our in-person guest speaker today, Dr. Hallerman. Before we introduce him, I just wanted to leave space for any announcements or updates or anything people would like to bring up. We are also live on Zoom, so if there's anyone in our virtual audience that would like to unmute themselves and give us an announcement or update, please feel free to do so. And I know that we have two symposiums coming up, so I thought that maybe if we could bring the slide over to our Sustainable Agri-Food Technology Summit first. Can we just hear a quick update and see, you know, that there's some poster sessions and some other registration dates we can talk about?
Sure thing, yes. So Jennifer and I lead a USDA NECO grant, and part of this is that we're organizing this workshop where the goal of the workshop is to explore the role of the novel agri-food technologies, including genetic engineering and other technologies, and the role of those according to different stakeholder perceptions in achieving more sustainable food and ag systems. So we have a registration. It's free to attend. We hope that you can all attend. And it's free, but you have to register by April 30th. And as Don mentioned, there's an opportunity for students and postdocs to share their work in the form of a poster presentation session. So that also has a registration date by the 30th. So hope you can all make it in the Plant Science Building.
And we'd love to have some Ag BioFew student representatives there as well. So I will send out that link again for students that are in person and online. And then I think we have one more.
Yeah, that's our societal and ethical implications of microbiome engineering in the built environment. And you're all invited. The first day is going to be, you know, mainly a talks, and the second day will be an in-person working group workshop discussing two case studies. And this is associated with our NSF Engineering Research Center. And so please join us. We have space in the in-person now for about a dozen people. So sign up quickly if you want to attend the in-person, but everybody can attend on Zoom. Is open to the public on May 15th. So, but Zoom will not be available on the 16th. So yeah, please join us.
Great. Thank you. So I will send links for both of these. So one is May 15th to 16th, and the other is May 21st. And is there another announcement?
An announcement that tomorrow, 11 o'clock, one of the candidates for executive director of the Genetics and Genomics Academy will be giving her vision talk, and that will be in Thomas Hall on the 3rd floor. So love to encourage people to come and participate.
Thank you. Anybody else before we get started? So I'm going to ask Eric Pototo to stand up, come here or stay there, and introduce our speaker.
Thanks, everyone. Today, our speaker is Dr. Eric Hallerman. He's an emeritus professor in the Department of Fish and Wildlife Conservation at Virginia Tech University. Just a little background on him. He received his BS and MS from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and a PhD at Auburn University in Fisheries and Aquaculture. At VTU, he included conservation genetics of fish, aquaculture genetics, aquaculture biotechnology and policy, which led him to various collaborations with USDA, the FDA, and then the FAO of the United Nations, and several other NGOs. Right now, he serves as the chair of an ad hoc committee appointed by the National Academies of Science to explore heritable genomic genetic modification of food animals. And today, he'll be talking about that work and gene and technologies in aquacultures and the constraints, potentials, and then products to commercialization. So without further ado, The floor is yours.
Thank you, Eric. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm really pleased to make an appearance here at the Genetic Engineering Society Center. Congratulations on having such a center. I wish we had one in Virginia Tech. Also, thank you to Jennifer and Dawn. Brett, I see your hand behind my invitation, but that may or may not be the case. Whatever, I'm pleased to be here with you. And I'll talk to you about aquaculture biotechnology and some of its implications. I'm imagining that nobody here is an expert in aquaculture, so let me set the stage just a little bit. Our capture of fishes in wild fisheries has been at a plateau since about 1986. It has not grown. There's even some question whether that's sustainable going forward. Yet our supply of fisheries products has continued to grow. It's from aquaculture. Aquaculture grew from about 4% of global fish supplies in 1970 to half of it today. That's phenomenal growth. That's 5 to 7% per year. And so this field in which I became interested when I was no older than the students in this room has grown to a degree that I never imagined when I started out. Aquaculture products are important to human nutrition, especially in developing countries, especially in Asia. 60 to 70% of the aquaculture production in the world is in Asia. Half of it is in China. If you were to take that away, people would not have as much protein in their diets. It's a big deal. And globally, aquaculture employs about 20 million people. That's an old number, by the way. All right, so intensification of aquaculture is important. Our world population is increasing. There's limited supplies of fish meal and oil. There's limited numbers of suitable sites, especially along coastlines. And clean water also constrains the growth of aquaculture. So what we have to do in order to meet the increasing demand for fisheries products is to improve our production systems. And that is going on. That's probably the mainstream of aquaculture science globally. We also have to improve our farmed types, the fish that we actually raise, or other aquatic organisms. Selective breeding is really effective for aquaculture species. Think about it. Most of these things are being domesticated during our lifetimes. There's a lot of genetic variation we can take in from the wild to select upon. And we can get gains in growth rate of 12 to 18% per generation in a lot of these species. The terrestrial agricultural people, in contrast, are happy to get a percent. We're getting 12 to 18. Oh my gosh, it's a lot. And there's other technologies we can bring in, including gene technologies, which is where I'll focus through this next hour, to classical gene transfer and genome editing. All right. Fishes are a really nice set of systems for applying gene technology. Fishes have high fecundity, often on the order of hundreds to even thousands of eggs per female per spawn. Protocols exist for artificial induction of spawning for most species. They wouldn't be aquaculture species, really, unless we were able to control their reproduction. There are some species where we do go to the wild to get our seed stock, but those are the exceptions. Fertilization of eggs is external. In fact, this is what I'm showing here. This is like salmon eggs. The eggs are in there. You activate them by adding water, and then you add the milk from the males and stir it around with a feather. It's as easy as that to achieve fertilization. And it's easily conducted in vitro, or in this case, in a plastic bucket. The eggs are relatively large, which is nice if you're doing micro-injection. You can move them around with them. Extend a pipette tip and insert your micro-injection needle. Compare that to the egg of a fruit fly or of a mammal. It's much easier. Embryonic and larval development occur outside the mother. We don't have to reimplant the fertilized eggs inside the mother. And the incubation and larval rearing methods are well established, often using some sort of upflow jar like that McDonald's jar. Those are fertilized eggs floating around right there. All right, and so we can easily apply gene technologies. I think in this group of people, I don't need to explain the difference between gene transfer and genome editing. The key point here is the classical gene transfer, as I practiced when I was actively involved in this as a postdoc, it's inefficient, and the integration of your vector, it's not directed to any particular place in the genome. The contrast here, using some genome editing technique, perhaps CRISPR-Cas9, is that it's much more efficient, often on the order of, say, 10 to 50%, and you're directing the integration of that modification to a specific site in the genome. I take it that you folks recognize these two ladies? Do I have to introduce them? Smiles. All right, so Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier. They won the Nobel Prize for biomedicine about 3 years ago for their development of CRISPR-Cas9. All right. So what I'm going to do in this morning's talk, then, is to talk about genetically modified and genome-edited aquatic organisms. I'll focus on regulatory issues, focusing on the case study of growth hormone transgenic Atlantic salmon in the United States. And at the very end, just briefly, I'll talk about larger contexts, the adoption of animal biotechnology globally. All right. So as I mentioned, fishes are a really nice set of organisms for doing gene technology work. And early on, starting in the 1980s, when I was a postdoc, we were doing a lot of work introducing new genes into fishes for aquaculture purposes. That first wave of experiments was to promote rapid growth, most often by introducing a growth hormone construct under some sort of novel genetic regulation. And so growth hormone transgenic Atlantic salmon, tilapia, common carp, walleye, northern pike, I could go on and on. I could probably name 20 species. So growth hormone genes were introduced. Other sorts of traits that were of interest, disease resistance, transfer cecropid into channel catfish or lactoferrin into grass carp, that was to achieve some sort of generalized resistance to bacterial infection. Better use of plant-derived feeds, phytase was introduced into tilapia. Phytase is the major phosphorus storage protein in soybean and many other plants. Fish don't utilize it very well. If you will, you feed them with soybean meal and the phosphorus comes out the back end of the fish. It would be better if that phosphorus was taken up as fish flesh, thereby more efficiently incorporating it into a growing fish. And introduce sterility. Why would you want that in a fish? Often when we're doing aquaculture, we're raising that in waters where the native, where that same species is native to that ecosystem. And when you have a cultured fish that's been selectively bred for aquaculture traits, you don't necessarily want it to escape and interbreed with fishes in the receiving ecosystem. So the ability to induce sterility to protect wild populations and to protect your investment in genetic engineering would be a good thing. So antisense gonadotropin releasing hormone was introduced in the rainbow trout, several genes to achieve transgenic sterilization of channel catfish, Atlantic salmon, common carp, I could go on with others. Okay. And in the last 10 to 12 years, genome editing techniques have been applied to a variety of aquaculture species as well. So all of these species that I'm showing here, including some of the top species for world aquaculture, including lots of the carps. Folks, a lot of the most cultured fishes in the world are carps. We regard them as trash fish in America. If you go to China, the odds are very good. You'd be served carp tonight. Okay. So what are some of the genes that have been targeted for editing in some of these species? Growth and muscle development, most often by knocking out the myostatin gene. This models what happens in double muscle Belgian blue cattle. So you have a lot more of the investment of growth of the fish invested into muscle tissue. Reproductive confinement, often by knocking out the DND or nanos genes. You're interfering with primordial germ cell formation such that the gonads won't develop normally and you have a sterile fish. Several different genes have been modified in an attempt to promote disease resistance, often by knocking out a receptor for a particular virus. And various other traits, coloration as much as anything, just to show that you know how to use your genome editing tool. And coloration is an important trait in the marketplace. Sometimes the consumer will pay a little bit more for a fish that has a different coloration is perceived as another product. There's an interesting one here, fatty acid metabolism in order to promote omega-3 fatty acid deposition in the flesh of Atlantic salmon. There are probably many other experiments that haven't been reported yet. This field is moving very quickly. All right. So the point that I want to make here with this first sequence of slides is that there's lots of interesting research and development activity, but there's been very little penetration of the marketplace. Only three genetically modified and genome-edited animal products have reached the marketplace. Do you guys know what they are, by the way, before I go any further? Kind of an unfair question. We'll get there. I just want to know what's the degree of expertise in the room. So the question that I'll ask, and I'll try to answer through most of the rest of my talk, is why is commercial production of transgenic animals for food purposes lagging so far behind crop plants? It's not just that big seed companies are pushing forward plants. There are other reasons. But I want to consider this in the context of a case study. And that's the Aquagami Atlantic salmon. How many of us have heard of this before? All right, most everybody. Very good. All right, but just basically, for the sake of those who have not, it's an Atlantic salmon that's expressing a growth hormone gene that was transferred to a Chinook salmon. And what? And that growth hormone gene is on different genetic regulations such that it's transcribed 365 days a year, as opposed to seasonally in the wild type Atlantic salmon. So you get a really dramatic growth acceleration early in life, which slows down, but you're still cutting your production time in half. To the aquaculturist, what that means is you get out two crops instead of one in a certain amount of time. That's a big deal. You're also getting an improvement in feed conversion efficiency, which is a big deal because feed is the most expensive input for producing fish. So with the prospect of shorter production time, reduced costs, improved efficiency and profitability, some aquaculturists were very interested in the possibility of rearing these fish. Well, how come that didn't happen? Well, the fish was in the regulatory pipeline for 20 years. It's not as simple as the government not having moved on it. We can get into that in the question and answer period if you like, but it was in the regulatory pipeline for a very long time. Before we get into that, I want to go on an aside here and tell you about how genetically modified animals are regulated in the United States. All right, we do not have an organic act that established regulatory authority over gene technology in the United States. For example, Australia has a gene technology act. Scandinavian countries, a couple of them have that. We don't. Instead of that, in the mid-1980s, the Office of Science and Technology Policy, which is part of the White House, said, we're going to take a different approach. What we're going to do is extend the coverage of existing laws to cover the products of biotechnology. And they call that policy the Coordinated Framework for the Regulation of Biotechnology. From here forth, the Coordinated Framework. And then the agencies who had authority under those respective laws began rulemaking to implement the Coordinated Framework. All right, so for genetically engineered animals, the scope of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act was extended that led to oversight by FDA, not the Department of Agriculture. And this will be important as we go forward. The FDA considers the recombinant DNA construct to be a new animal drug. These animals are regulated as if they were drugs. And they will get down on you saying, no, it's not the animal, it's the transgene that's being regulated. At the end of the day, that's a distinction without a difference. Because you have to go through a drug approval process, and that costs a lot of money. It's a drug because it's an article intended to alter the structure or function of the animal. And so new animal drugs are licensed under a showing that the product is safe and effective for the intended use. So what does that mean in practice? Well, the FDA came out with GFI 187, Guidance for Industry 187, that laid out this process for oversight. You have to characterize the recombinant DNA construct. You have to characterize the lineage. Basically, you have to show where that transgene was integrated into the genome, characterize the phenotype. Okay, we do that anyway. Is it durable? Is this construct stably transmitted between generations? Is the food you're producing safe? Is it safe in the environment under the conditions under which you will produce it? And does it do what you say it will do? Does it grow in half the time of a conventional Atlantic salmon in this case? And only with successful passage through all these steps would this product be licensed for commercialization in the United States. Okay, any questions before we go any further? Because this is sort of important. All right, so just to show that things are still not entirely in stasis, 4 years ago, the Department of Agriculture released advance notice post rulemaking on regulation of the movement of animals modified or developed by genetic engineering and sought public comment. There is push and pull between FDA and USDA over who regulates genetically modified animals. It's been like this since the beginning. In some cases, it's up close and personal among individuals in the federal government. I'm not going to go there. But there's some push and pull is my real point about it. USDA would like to see these products regulated as animals and not as drugs. All right. So what USDA said is they'd like to establish a flexible, risk-based, science-based framework for the regulation of animals modified and developed using genetic engineering or genome editing. They're intended for agricultural purposes. It's still pending. What am I showing here?
Nice.
It's a glacier. It's moving at a glacial pace. All right, back to our case study. All right, so the regulatory history here. The transgene was first introduced with these Atlantic salmon in 1987. And so Aquabiotic Technologies, actually AF Protein, which was the forerunner of it, began speaking with the Department of Agriculture in 1993. There was no clear regulatory path at that time for GM animals. And so there were meetings with an interagency committee that was organized by USDA. And what they determined is USDA is not the lead agency, it's FDA. And so Aquabiotic at that time, which by then it was 1995, filed an application for an investigational new animal drug permit with the intent to commercialize the salmon that long ago. Well, it was highly controversial. In fact, one thing that I'll point out, it was controversial because it was known. Aquabiotic was very straightforward with the public and with everybody. This is what we're looking to do, folks. We're doing it in the light of day. They showed real courage with that. So let's give them credit for it. Well, what were the issues? Well, there were two of them that were predominant, at least from the science point of view. They were food safety and environmental safety. Well, so what are the key risk pathways here? One of them is the bioactivity of the gene product. Could salmon growth hormone gene, if it's at elevated levels, bind to receptors in human children and make them grow into giants? Well, it won't, because salmon growth hormone does not bind onto the human growth hormone receptor and elicit secretion of insulin like growth factor one. In fact, we've had bovine growth hormone that was injected as recombinant bovine somatotropin into milk for 2 decades by then, and we weren't getting giant children. It was a non-issue. So salmon growth hormone is not bioactive in humans. Allergenicity could be an issue. Fish is one of the allergenic groups. There's about 10 different animal foods that elicit allergens in some human consumers. Well, it's a Chinook salmon growth hormone gene being expressed in a fish background. If you're allergic to fish, you're not going to buy the product anyway. So allergenicity is not really an issue here either. Well, environmental safety is the larger issue as far as I was concerned. I'm a fish guy. I had been producing growth hormone transgenic fish myself. I published my concerns about it going back as far as 1990. And what we figured out fairly early on is that there's a risk assessment, risk management paradigm that works pretty well here. It came in from oversight of chemical agents and had been around since the 70s or maybe earlier. And what we could do is apply the classical risk assessment paradigm to genetically modify animals and plants. So the first thing is you identify potential harms. These are outcomes. What happens after you've gone through a number of things I'm about to talk about? What are you scared of at the end of the day? In this case, what we'd be concerned about is loss of locally adapted wild populations of Atlantic salmon would be the outcome that we'd be most scared of in this context. We'd identify the hazard that might lead to the harms. Well, that's the transgene or the transgenic fish, however you care through that. You address the probability of exposure to that hazard. Well, that's the likelihood of escape of the animals from an aquaculture facility and its persistence in the receiving ecosystem, then to interbreed with the wild population. Then you assess the probability of harm being realized given the exposure. Well, if these fish are out there, would they survive? Would they reproduce? Would the young be viable? Would there be back crossing and spread of that transgene from the point where that fish escaped more widely, say in the fjords of Norway or wherever it is you want to focus your attention? At the end of the day, risk is a probability. The compound probability of exposure times the probability of the harm being realized given exposure. I'll bring this up again because we're going to talk about P to B in just a little bit. All right, ecological risk is considered on a case-by-case basis, talking about the host species, the introduced genetic construct, in this case, a growth hormone construct, the integration of that, the particular integration of that transgene into an Atlantic salmon genome, and then it has to be considered in an ecological context, so you have to consider it in the context of a particular receiving ecosystem. This sort of and analysis had been around for a few years. It was incorporated in a report that the National Research Council published in 2002. Today, Dr. Kuzma was one of the staffers at the NIS. We've known each other for over two decades. All right. So before I came involved in the risk assessment for the salmon, there had been some studies. And what they did is they looked at single traits. And I'll go through this just quickly just so you have a sense of it. Fish are breathing oxygen in the parts per million range as it's dissolved in water. And the amount of dissolved oxygen is often limited to the distribution of Atlantic salmon. And the transgenics needed more dissolved oxygen than the wild type. The transgenics had less energy, free energy in their bodies than wild type because they had already used it to invest in more growth. So under starvation, they depleted their body protein, dry matter, lipids, and energy more quickly, and they had less to begin with. The transgenics, in order to support their rapid growth, fed more, and they were willing to feed in the presence of predators, which for a fish in the wild is a bad thing. I mean, those ospreys or hawks or eagles would take you out of the system faster than you think. Its multiplication is the process by which a small fish, as it grows, loses its par marks, little dark marks, and becomes silvery. It becomes physiologically ready to move from fresh water into salt water. And it's very important that it enter salt water at the right time of year. And the transgenic reached smolt size sooner, but the transition into that smolt life stage was not inhibited by high temperature or light conditions. Hence, these fish likely would migrate in appropriate times of the year. In terms of cardiorespiratory function, which for salmon is a big deal, they had lower metabolic scope, lower critical swimming speed. Basically, what I'm building up to through all of this is that all these traits would suggest that these animals were less fit in the wild. And there was a school of thought out there to which aquabounty scientists adhered and said, well, they look unfit. If they get out in the ecosystem, natural selection will take them right out. There's nothing to worry about. Someone like me, a fish guy, looks at this and says, that's really naive. Because what you want to do is look at the overall fitness of the organism. Everybody in fitness, the two components, students, survival and reproduction, right? Some heads nodding up and down. Good. All right, so I won't put that on the quiz on Tuesday. All right, so what you want to do is look at the integrated phenotype of the whole organism, because the organism will live or die, will reproduce or not. That's what fitness is. And so what we wanted to do is look at the net fitness of the transgenic salmon relative to the non-transgenic comparator. So we looked at six different traits at issue: juvenile viability, age of sexual maturity, mating success, fecundity of the females, fertility of the males, and adult viability. At that point, aquabounty, to my surprise, contacted me. I had been one of their largest critics, and they said, Eric, we want you to do an experiment like this. We want you to do it because you've been a vocal critic. If you do it, it will be credible. And I was surprised, thought about it, called it back, and said, let's do this. And so I pulled together a team with Ewan McLean, then at Virginia Tech, with Ian Fleming and Garth Fletcher at the Memorial University of Newfoundland. Garth was one of the founders of AF Protein, which morphed into aquabounty a little bit later. And we couldn't do all of it, but we focused on these three traits. All right, so now we go into the lab. And we can't do it in the wild for obvious reasons. So what we have here are a series of gravel, beds of gravel in these upflow cylinders that basically mimic Atlantic salmon reds in a river. What the female salmon does is she excavates a pit, and as the gravel goes in, water will go through it, and that aerates her eggs. So this simulates that. And we will put single spawns in each of those and track who swam up. We also had an artificial stream. Here's Derek Moreau checking the behavior of salmon in it. We found no difference between the transgenics and the controls regarding an oxygen consumption as they were in the reds, their developmental rate, their survival until they emerged from the gravel, and later on as they fed, there was no difference in behavior between the transgenics and the controls. There was no difference in growth and survival in that artificial stream. Frankly, I was surprised by this. I thought the transgenics, that their survival and growth would be impeded. It was not. There was no difference, basically. Age of sexual maturity. I have to go down a bit of a rabbit hole here. The males have different life histories in Atlantic salmon. The classical one you think about is how the parents migrate upstream into fresh water. They find the very pool where they had been spawned years before. The males make territories, try and attract females, who then fan out that red, and she deposits her eggs and the male fertilizes them. That's the parental male life history, and that's the one that we were taught when I was in undergrad, is the common one. Well, there's two others. Grills migrate to sea for 1 year instead of two or more, and they come back small males. And what they do is they hide behind rocks or plants. And when this parental male has a female, he'll run in there, shed milt, and run away before he gets beaten up. And there's yet another life history morph called Precocious Par. This guy has his par marks. He never went to sea. He might only be this big. He does the same bit. He hides in the rocks or the weeds. And when that big male is mating with a female, he'll run out and shed milt and thereby realize some fitness. You commit to one or the other. You don't go from one to another. You commit early on. And a lot of it has to do with how fast you're growing. If you're going fast, you're more likely to take one of these alternative life history strategies. These par can get an awful lot of fertilizations, by the way. In some streams, especially if there's a high exploitation rate on the parental males, they'll get most of the fertilizations. All right, so what we hypothesize is that because of the rapid early growth of the growth hormone transgenics, they might mature young more frequently, and that might be a really important route for progression of the transgene into natural populations. So what we found is that the transgenics matured far less frequently than the non-transgenics. They put more of their energy into growth and not into gonadal development. So the hypothesis that PAR might be an important route in progression of the transgene is not supported. Quote one of the Huxleys, a beautiful hypothesis slain by an ugly fact. All right. What we did, I think, was the most important experiment. We looked at mating success. And what we did is we had artificial spawning channels. They're basically circular streams out in an enclosed area. And we put in some transgenic and some non-transgenic fish and just let them mate. And we knew, because they had different genetic markers, we looked at microsatellites, who fathered whom. And what we found, first of all, is that for the par, no, these are the anadromous ones, that the wild type spawn much more frequently than the transgenics. The wild types in the gray bars, transgenics in the white bars, but they had non-zero mating success. The transgenics didn't get matings. For the par, similarly, the wild type had more matings than the transgenics, but again, reproductive fitness for the transgenics was not zero. So putting all of this together, survival fitness, at least early in the life cycle, remember that most of the salmon die before they ever get this big. The early survival was the same between transgenics and wild type. Net fitness, at least for reproduction, is reproductive fitness of the transgenics is less than the wild type. Net fitness is reduced. So if you were to have a single pulse of these fish into a receiving population, natural selection would remove them. But what if you have a production system like a floating net pen where animals are escaping just every so often? And each farm may have 20 to 50 of these net pens, and you may have multiple farms in a particular fjord ecosystem. That slow leakage might be a large part of your spawning population. You'd have recurring introductions, hence this simple notion, oh, selection will take them away, is at the end of the day naive. Further, outcomes will differ between different ecological contexts. What we modeled was survival, growth, and reproductive fitness in our particular systems. These fish being grown in every Norwegian fjord, every Canadian bay that they're raised in, we can't model all of that. And there might be genotype by environment interactions. So we can't anticipate in any rigorous way what is the risk in all potential receiving ecosystems. One other wrinkle in all of this is the notion of, well, what system are you rearing them in? Remember that risk is a function of the probability of exposure. So we can minimize ecological risk by culturing transgenic fish under strict confinement. When I showed PowerPoint more detailed, basically following along the lines of what you've just seen, I was having lunch with the executives of Aqua Bounty. And to my surprise, the CEO turned to me and said, okay, Eric, we hear you. We'll raise them under strict confinement. And he looked around the table, And I looked around the table. I thought I'd have somebody bursting veins in their temple. It didn't happen. And what I will add is that they were true to their word. So what Apple Bounty said is we're going to change our product definition. The way we manufacture our drug is as follows. They produce the eggs at a single facility in Prince Edward Island, as well could find. And then they're going to be grown out in Canada or just to egg stage. And they're shipped to a culture, to a land-based culture facility in Indiana. So this geographical confinement. These fish escaped in central Indiana. They're not going to find another Atlantic salmon population. They're not going to survive. It's too warm. The locations were FDA and DFO inspected, and they had lots of physical confinement. Water is pumped through filters and such. Water, any water that's discharged from the facility has been through redundant filtration. Even the young life stages can't escape. And they're going to produce all female triploid fishes. They can use hormonal treatments on the brood stock, and they can apply hydrostatic pressure early on in embryogenesis to get triploids. These fish are sterile. So you have geographic, physical, and reproductive confinement. All right, so in 2012, the Food and Drug Administration asked for finding no significant impact for the conditions of use, in quotes, for the transgenic Atlantic salmon. It took 3 years, was bottled up at the White House. There's all sorts of apocryphal stories as to why, but the FDA finally approved the application to be aquabatic salmon. So this was the first approval of an animal product, a GM animal product anywhere in the world. And so its importance was much greater than for the salmon. So Aqua Bounty is now producing the salmon in a facility in Albany, Indiana. They're building a second facility in Ohio. Product is on the market today. You can't go to the store and buy it. They sell it to wholesalers. So the issue, are they labeled? No, they're not. The wholesaler is what they are. Either that's fillets or single portions. And Aqua Bounty is looking to start up elsewhere. They've had field trials in Brazil and Argentina. This one is probably done by now in China. I haven't talked to them in a bit. The product is approved in Brazil, but they don't have a local partner to produce them commercially just yet. All right, so that's the Aqua Bounty salmon. Genome editing, I'm going to focus on just one thing just to give you a sense of what's going on. I'm going somewhere with this. Myostatin is a key regulator of skeletal muscle growth. If you silence the myostatin gene, what you do is you get the double muscle phenotype you get in Piedmontese or Belgian blue cattle. Myostatin knockout leads to very muscular mice. Since then, it's been applied to a number of different species to much the same outcome. But the key one is red sea bream in Japan. And the myostatin receptor was knocked out in red sea bream, or the leptin receptor in Torifugu puffer. And what we found is that fillet yield was greatly increased. This animal has a deeper body and thicker fillet than the wild type. And so a petition was given to the Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare in Japan. And what they determined is that since there was no recombinant DNA involved in the production of these fish, that this was not a living modified organism. LMO is a term that you get under the Cartagena Protocol. We're not signatories of it, but it's basically a GMO and an LMO. And so it's not a regulated article. And so there was nothing to impede the commercialization of these products in Japan. And these are the first genome-edited food products to reach the UN food supply. It's marketed by the Regional Fish Institute based in Kyoto. Well, there are many other genome-edited animals that are in the R&D pipeline. Some of them are pretty exciting. Old cattle, they lack horns. You don't have to take the horns off mechanically. That's nicer for the animals. Slip cattle have a lighter coat. You can have European breeds being raised in tropical areas and they don't overheat. Myostatin knockout cattle to get beefier animals. Cattle with allergen-free milk. Genetically castrated pigs, so we don't have to do it to them mechanically. Again, that's a benefit for animal welfare. Foot and mouth disease resistant pigs and reproductively confined Atlantic salmon. Well, there are still animals that are hung up in the regulatory mill. The question that I'll ask is, will other GM animal food products be approved? This business of regulating GE animals in the United States as drugs has led at least one group, Jim Murray and Leslie Magus Group at the University of California, Davis, to take their license on goats, and they moved most of their stock to Fortaleza in Brazil. Actually, Brazil has one of the most progressive GM oversight regulatory systems that there is. So, and that GM milk would be put to better use in a poorer country than our own. Other countries have well-developed animal biotech programs. China is probably the leader. They or us, I mean, those are the two that lead above all others. And they have some interesting lines, including disease-resistant pigs and cattle. For instance, foot and mouth disease-resistant pigs. Producing them would be a real boon for Chinese agriculture. China seems really gun-shy about going ahead and approving anything. They've had food safety fiascos in China, and their Food and Drug Administration is not well-regarded by the public. So, trying to keep this short, I'm going to make a couple of points and then open this up, hopefully, for some spirited discussion. We're at a critical point in human history. When I was born, and it wasn't that long ago, there were 3 billion people on the planet. By the time I check out, there will be 9 billion in one human lifetime. That's a lot of pressure on our planet. Can we adapt? Well, animal biotechnology, I would argue, can contribute to the sustainability and resilience of livestock production on a crowded, warming planet. But to realize these benefits, we need not just the innovation. What we need is enabling regulation that creates a pathway to the market so that people can see it and invest in it, and innovators can get their products into the hands of farmers. We also need engagement with the private and NGO sectors and the public. That's where the social science comes in. That's where I'm really pleased to see that students at NC State are getting training in social science and not just in the biological science. The question that I'll leave you with is, will regulatory systems and publics become more amenable to animal biotechnology? Before opening it up, I'll mention that I have gotten my research funding in this area from the USDA Biotechnology Risk Assessment Research Grants Program and from the Foreign Agricultural Service of USDA. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Talk too long.
It's okay. We still have plenty of time for a good discussion. I just want to remind everyone who's online that you're welcome to join in the discussion. So if you'd like to ask your question directly, use the raise your hand function. If you would like for me to read your question, just throw it in the chat.
Just a question. When you were kind of going by the trait-by-trait assessments that were being conducted, I'm really curious on who is actually conducting that. And like what, like is it industry? Like was it Aqua Bounty itself? Like who's doing it and how do you kind of piece it together into a full story? So I know that they called you and they're like, hey, like let's do this.
That's the model for doing it.
Yeah.
Often it might be done within a company, but it's been rather little done till now.
Okay.
And that's a real issue. I mean, I think Aqua Bounty was pretty heads up to get their most vocal critic to do it. In fact, I know where this came from. We were at a meeting. All places, Moscow, and we had dinner together, and we argued, well, how would you ever figure out whether it's safe? And we just over dinner laid out an experiment, and I was shocked that about a month later, I get the phone call. How unlikely was that? By the way, it was an FDA person that sat us down, why don't we all have dinner together? Can that be replicated? It was a happenstance. In general, I think it would be within an industry, but they might hire out to a consultant or something, but each case will be its own story.
Yeah, so we were laying out some of the changes that Aqua Bounty put into place based on our recommendations or based on some of the risks that we have. As a company, I think that's really responsible, but how much value loss did they have and what kind of price increase did they have to have based on that?
Speak up just a little. How much price would they have to have?
How did the price increase and maybe how much loss did the company have? Because obviously they put a lot of value in that. So, but they took a hit having to design their product as specific.
Okay. All right. So it costs a little more for them to produce it than it would for a Norwegian company or a Chilean company to fly in Atlantic salmon. What they are really big on, why are they in Indiana? They're an easy driving distance to market in Chicago. So what they're saying is super fresh product, and they don't talk about it being transgenic. They talk about it being healthy and fresh. What they're selling is not a transgenic product, but they're selling as a fresh product. Marketing is a big deal. All right, so it's a little bit more expensive to raise it in research systems, but they're selling sustainability and freshness. I think their margin might be less than for some large company. Do you eat Atlantic salmon much? I eat a fair amount. I can usually tell just by forking it whether it's cultured or whether it's wild. And the product from the net pens is not wonderful. I have not eaten the Aqua Bounty salmon, but I'm told that it's less fatty. And so it tastes a little different, I'm told. So that might be a part of it too. I've been angling to get some of this fish to eat for a few years now. I just can't seem to get it. Jennifer?
We have a question from Emma Kovac online. What are the impacts of non-transgenic farm salmon escaping from open pet pens? And how does their fitness differ from the escaped Aqua Bounty salmon?
All right, so fishes do escape from net pen aquaculture all the time. The net pens have gotten better over the years. But, say, in central Norway, if you look at the population genetics of the fish, the introgression of the aquacultured fish into the wild fish, such that the native genetic structure, the differentiation between populations is all wiped out. They look like cultured fish. That's why there are aquaculture zones in Norway and wild management zones in Norway. It's beyond argument anymore. In fact, it's reached the point where in eastern Canada, you can't raise Norwegian fish anymore. There, out in Maine, they raise selectively bred lines that were sourced in those areas so that they would be locally adapted so you wouldn't have that loss of local adaptation. You got a question?
Yeah, I'm wondering if you might talk a little bit about the PLR slick cattle and the first gene-edited animal product that's been approved in the U.S. and how it went through a different kind of framework than the Aqua Bounty from a regulatory standpoint.
Right, so,
and whether you think that's hopeful or not for
the
field.
All right, so the slick cattle have a lighter coat. Now, if you look at cattle in the winter, they're pretty hairy, right? And if you were to take those cattle and put them in Panama, they're not going to do well. They're going to be heat stressed. So there is a mutation that occurs naturally in tropical cattle. It's happened in the prolactin receptor gene. It's happened many times in the domestication and selective breeding of cattle. What this does is the genome editing mimics a set of mutations that happen anyway. So Recombinetics, which is a company that's based in Eagan, Minnesota, basically use genome editing to put those sorts of traits into Elvis Holsteins and into Angus, whatever, into several breeds. And so what FDA decided is that this was low regulatory priority because this is a mutation that happens anyway. The animals seem just fine. I'm more than fine by them having done it. In fact, risk scaled. There's not much risk there. That sounds good to me. You don't have to regulate this as a drug. It's no different than the wild type. If they had to introgress that mutation into a selectively bred background, you would lose a lot of your selective breeding. You'd have to select a lot of generations of cattle to perform well while having that prolactin receptor allele. You'd lose an awful lot of investment in selective breeding. So you can do it in a generation one. You could get your nucleus stocked for doing that much more quickly than if you're just introgressing.
So they didn't have to go through the drug?
They did not have to go through it. And I wish they would have a statement of policy that said that they were going to have this sort of risk scaling approach. But they're still studying what, in fact, I think that's why the committee that I'm part of was founded in part.
Yeah, so I have a couple questions. You know, we're growing striped bass now with my colleague Ben Reading, and we're doing selective breeding, and we get improvements about 15% per generation. So what is the cost-benefit analysis of doing a transgenic fish or other animals as opposed to simply selectively breeding? It took 20 years to get approval. That's what, 3-7 generations of Atlantic salmon growth improvement, just brought up.
Okay.
So I'm kind of wondering.
I've been asked variations of that question many times.
Mm-hmm.
And in Norway, they always ask me, well, does Aqua Bounty salmon grow faster than our selectively bred salmon? And the answer I have to give them, I don't know. They've never been grown side by side. And I don't think the Norwegians want to have that comparison. I don't think Aqua Bounty wants that comparison. Aqua Bounty did not think it would take them as many generations to get
right.
It. But if I was doing selective breeding and I was getting 15% per generation, I'd be happy with that and I'd keep breeding.
Right. And then I have another question. I'm not familiar with the leptin receptor knockout, was it?
Yeah.
What fish is that?
All right, that was the Torfugu puffer.
Mm-hmm. And they got increased body mass.
Yeah.
Interesting. Because we study that. We haven't observed any of that.
Because they're eating more, right?
Are they eating more?
Because leptin controls appetite. Right.
Well, no, they're eating more.
Yeah.
All right. So that was a piece that I didn't know. I didn't know why it worked, but okay.
Oh,
leptin
yeah.
Controls appetite.
Yeah. So leptin suppresses appetite. And so with the receptor knockout, there's no signaling back to that. So leptin can't say, stop eating.
So the fish keeps
eating. Yeah, yeah,
so you're getting more throughput through your system and you can produce a fatter fish.
So I did something similar, but with your rainbow trout. And what we found is in our leptin receptor knockout fish, that those fish were hyperphagic and they just ate infinitely more than the wild type fish.
Maybe is it good for aquaculture? So
they grow faster, right? So it's kind of like the idea for the aqua bounty, right? So it's like if you're getting a larger product quicker, then that's great because that's less time that you're maintaining your systems and things. But then at the end of the day, what does that do to lake quality? Water quality and things like that.
So you'll work with your diet, you'll work with your feeding regimes to optimize.
Right, yeah.
And there's probably a space in there where you can get a very nice solution.
Yeah.
We have two questions online. The first is from Keith Edmiston, and he asked, does Aqua Advantage plan to market in grocery stores in the future?
All right, so I'm not really privy, but I have spoken to the folks, and they haven't saturated the market that they're in. What they do is they sell a lot of folks that portion it out and sell it as that. So until they max that out, they're not going to go ahead. They're going to have their new facility probably go online in 2024. So that'll more than double their output. So at some point, they're going to have to start marketing more generally. And the next question always comes up, will they label it? And they've said that they would. And then I didn't hear anything for a while. And now I know what it's going to be. So question in the room.
I was curious about the double muscle thing, right? So you have those double muscle blues, right? And that's fine, even though we know that that affects them, their quality of life or whatever. And so then you can obviously do a lot of breeding that's going to lead to maybe animal welfare issue, but that's not really. But if you do it transgenically and make a double muscle, then
I don't know. I don't know data to do it, but remember something about fish. Their growth is not as determinant as it is in mammals, right? It's a lot more plastic. So you might just get a larger, more muscular animal without some of the pleiotropies that you get in mammals. But I have not seen good data on animal welfare on the fish.
It's hard to get welfare data on fish.
It is. And I've tried any number of times to be in touch with the Regional Fish Institute, and they'll talk to you about what they want to talk about. They won't talk to you about just anything. I don't think they have the data.
Maybe an observation, and your presentation really made me kind of shift my thinking on that, about salmon and more to think of it as really effectively like lab-grown meat or getting close to that, because it's such an industrial operation, like so removed from the environment that it just seems like they're sort of like becoming a finer and finer distinction between what's like lab grown meat versus, and I guess the one question would be, how is lab grown meat regulated? Is it still an FDA through that FDA conduit, or how would it be regulated? Inspection?
I don't know what to tell you. I don't know if it's regulated.
Yeah.
All right, but to the point, rearing fish and recirculating in aquaculture systems has become a sector. If you thought that was intensive, I was just in Hungary 2 weeks ago, and they're raising African catfish. And production of the fish is astronomical. These fish breathe air. So what they do is they feed the heck out of them in tanks that are smaller than this room. And they'll get thousands of pounds of fish out of these tanks. I mean, there's almost as many fish as there is water. And what happens, they say, well, is this awful crowded? Well, the fish do better when you crowd them because then they don't try to establish territory. They just surrender to the notion they can't have their own space. And then they just worry about eating. It can get more intensive than that. Think about how we rear pigs. Think about how we rear chickens. To the point of how do we regulate lab grown meat? I don't know.
Can you talk about consumer acceptance of these products And so like in comparison to like GM crops, like.
Okay, that's a good question. All right, so whenever you get to animals, you talk about an organism, you look at it, it looks back at you. That's different. And issues of whether it's suffering, that's a serious question. As opposed to, is this corn or the soybean suffering? That's not an issue. Some people in the public are really grossed out by the notion of genetically modified animals. And so there's been pushback. If you look back into the 90s and the 2000s, there were celebrity chefs saying, I will never cook with an aqua bounty salmon. There are some supermarket chains that we'll never stop this product. And so there was huge pushback. And that's why I always get the question, will they label it? Because some people will shun it. And really, I think part of the growth of the organic sector is people that don't want to eat genetically modified corn and soybeans. They don't want any part of industrial agriculture. And that's why that segment, which was a few percent of the market when I was a young man, is now a chunk of it. You have whole stores full of organic produce. That never used to be. I think some of that is pushback. I've spoken at many sorts of different panel discussions. Somehow I'm always cast as the one that's pro-biotech. I'm agnostic on it, really. But since I'm the one that is decrying it everywhere, I start asking people, what is it about it that really puts you off? But when you come right down to it, a lot of it is industrial agriculture. They don't like, well, Monsanto is no longer a freestanding company, but they don't like chickens being produced in cages that are this big. They don't like veal. But they don't like, they have in mind the family farm. So there's all these issues that are put together. And there's pushback. It's the simple answer to your question.
Just a comment on that. Like, I think last year, I started digging into the aqua bounty salmon. And like in Indiana, or maybe Ohio, the one that's planned, I know there was some pushback, but it was less about like, oh, genetically modified salmon are scary, but it was about the concerns of water. And they were viewing it as like, well, they're setting up here because we have an aquifer here. And there was big concerns about, I think, you know, the amount of water it would take in this process, but then also like the cleanliness of water that would go through it. And yeah, I don't know if I got the full scope because I was like looking on these like little news articles from the community and, you know, whatever, but it seemed to me that it was like post approval from FDA, then it opened up this new can of worms that almost required another sort of like environmental assessment of like what's going on with the water. And I actually don't know what all came out from that, but I don't know if you could speak on that at all.
I haven't heard that.
Okay.
Right, so it's recirculating.
Yeah,
it does take water, but look at agriculture.
Yeah.
Were they in the Tays Aquifer? Do you happen to know?
Yeah.
T-A-Y-S?
Yeah, I think so. It's the one that like spans across three states.
That's it. That's the Tays Aquifer. It should be enough to support it, especially if they clean up the water. They should look at their whole water budget before they point at one thing. I'm wondering if it's a red herring.
Probably. But I think what like the concern was like, oh, well, you haven't looked at this yet. So it was almost like the thing is being planned on top of the aquifer.
Well, okay. So FDA approved the product, but
yeah,
it's up to the locals to say if they have enough water.
Yeah.
But I would ask, are you saying that for every enterprise that's thinking of coming to your county in Ohio? Is it fair or unfair? And I can't speak to the facts of it. I just don't know.
I'm sorry, we have to call it. It's already 1 o'clock. Thank you for a great presentation and for good questions. If everyone help me thank Eric. And I just want to remind you that next week we will have Barbara Prepare Hawthorne, and she'll be talking about investigating the societal and ethical implications of synthetic cells. That will be online only, so don't come to this room. Just join us from your computer, and we'll see you next week. Thank you.